netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today, Mike Seymour is going to talk with Lou Levinson from Laser Pacific about restoring the film Saving Private Ryan. Before we get to that, I just wanted to mention a couple of things. First of all, NAB, I hope you caught our three FX Guide TV episodes we recorded at NAB 2011. We also recorded a lot of other content you'll be seeing in coming episodes. Also, the new term has begun over at fxphd.com. It's a great lineup, this term, and I can't tell you how many people came up to me at NAB and just said how much they enjoyed FXPhd, and many people have said that, you know, they got their start in the business after taking classes at FXPhd, so that's very gratifying, and if you haven't checked it out, I hope you'll head over to fxphd.com and check it out. Also, John and Ian are on their way over to FMX in Germany for the first time to check out that show. And, of course, after that, we're planning for Vancouver for SIGGRAPH and also for IBC. Also, check out the RC podcast. The guys have been doing quite a bit of great work over there, and we did the live event at NAB that was the last podcast. The latest one covers S-Log and talks a lot about various issues involving shooting. And I gotta say, the number of times lately that in the post-production side, I've been involved in discussions about the production side. The RC podcast really helps you keep informed about developments as they change hourly in the production world these days. Anyway, let's jump in now with Mike Seymour talking with Lou Levinson from Laser Pacific.
So you're involved in the restoration of Saving Private Ryan, which is both an incredibly important film, but one that doesn't seem particularly old. Is it in need of restoration?
Well, one of the things we find is that, you know, negatives can be particularly fragile things by themselves, and pretty much any handling will get you into some dirt and things like that. So we have seen some examples of relatively recent movies where the negatives, due to rushing to get prints out or something like that, you know, answer prints for particular screenings, the negatives have maybe taken a little bit more damage than everybody involved would have liked to have seen.
So let me just discuss the process of how Saving Private Ryan would have been done, because the film had some very interesting, cinematography aspects that translated also into grading aspects. Obviously, most notably, I guess, was the fact that on set they were using a short shutter, which caused a very staccato and interesting look. But, of course, the film had a very distinctive grade, a look about it. Was that film done with a full DI at the time that it was done, or was it done with a photochemical process of...
At that point, it was purely photochemical. I mean, you mentioned the short shutter angle. They probably pulled every photographic trick they could. They were using, in some cases, they were using period lenses. In some cases, they even had, I think there was one case where they had a drill with an off-balance weight in it spinning that was attached to the camera to shake it. But the question about grading is, it was what was known, or what Technicolor calls an ENR release. It was a silver retention process. So the prints, negative was processed normally. The prints were done in a silver retention fashion to do what silver retention does, which is richen up the blacks, do a little bit of desaturation, and then shift the colors around a little bit.
Because in a photographic sense, there's no way to, for example, when you're color timing a film, increase the contrast of the film. Because in the old days before DI, you could change the printer lights, but you couldn't actually go around and, of course, do anything selective. You couldn't do anything like just an overall contrast adjustment. So if you wanted to get that, that was your only option, wasn't it?
Right. Well, you had some choices. You could, for example, actually process, you bleach bypass process the negative or something and try and get the contrast in from the negative. But I believe in this particular case, the release prints were all done processing that way to kind of simplify it. And then also, when you start fooling with those photochemical processes, you're in a land of where if you have to do it again in a year, good luck getting the same results.
Yeah, so you're operating without a net, really, aren't you?
Yeah, pretty much.
So now, let's obviously, in a normal film process, you're going to have original camera negative. At some point, you're going to produce an interpose so that you can strike internegs, so that you can do the release prints, because you obviously don't want to wear out the master neg by striking all the prints off it. So what actual film have you got hold of to do the restoration? Have you gone back to the original camera negative or where?
Yes, we actually, in this case, we scanned the original camera negative on a Northlight 1, you know, pin registered 4K. At that point, we did not have a Northlight 2, so then we were using what amounts to a 6K array to make 4K files. The first video, the video transfers that preceded this transfer were done actually by transferring an ENR print, by actually using one of the answer prints to help get the look of the film. And then for this, because we wanted to get all the information we could in terms of spatial resolution and grayscale bit depth if we ran into a situation where we needed it. Although, you know, the minute you mention ENR, you have to take grayscale with a grain of salt. But you know, we ran the original negative through the scan on this point, so it was pin registered scanning, and at that point, I think Northlight 1 was probably running somewhere around 3 or 4 seconds a frame, and Private Ryan is 9 reels, so it probably took us somewhere in the neighborhood of 3.5 weeks to scan it.
So people obviously tend to focus on the fact that something's scanned at 4K or at 2K or whatever, but you actually got an enormous benefit just from the fact that you'd gone back, because we don't think of it this way, but that process of interneg and interpos is effectively a two-generational process. So just in terms of best lab in the world, you're going to get a better-looking picture that if it hasn't been printed to a neg and then printed to a pos, aren't you? I mean, right away out of the gate.
Well, I mean, I don't know that I would, you know, this case is a case why you wouldn't necessarily want to use the language better-looking picture. But we certainly start out with more information than we ever started out with before. And that allows us to go to actually say, okay, well, we're going to exactly recreate ENR, or we're going to go, well, you know, let's back that off a little bit for this scene or for that shot. So you have more choices, but you are starting from a point of where the original source material really doesn't bear a whole lot of relationship to what your final look target is.
Which brings us to that question of how hard it was to create that look of the print when you're going back to the original camera neg, because obviously you've got great reference, but did it take you long to get the look sorted out in terms of being able to recreate it?
It takes a little bit in the beginning always to get your feet on the right road, because it's always a matter of, as a colorist, some of this is just feel, where you're hunting for what the element will give you and hunting for the right place and the look. And once you get it, unless, you know, the photography is all over the map or something, which in this case it certainly wasn't, you know, it's a little bit hard, because this was a little bit tricky because of the amount of contrast involved, and actually the amount of contrast I had to add in electronically was so high that I actually ran out of contrast, the ability to add contrast in one base light layer, and actually had to double up to get enough contrast. But beyond that, once you do it, you're actually pretty much rolling along. And the way we do these things is we actually have a print, you know, where I can like make my first pass and then watch the print and then do final tweaks and then move on. So I do in fact have an answer print that, you know, the creatives, you know, I have better access to the creative intent than a lot of people who might be doing something like this.
The files you're getting out of the scanner, were they Cineon 10-bit log, or were you getting out a 12-bit linear, or what were you getting out of the film scanner in terms of what was the dynamic range of the bit depth?
Well, this particular project was done with, you know, with 10-bit DPX files, so it's basically log, you know, log densities. We've done some things since then running 16 bits out of the scanner and running 16 bits through the entire system, but this particular project preceded that.
And, of course, in addition to the technology of the day being color grading, the technology of the day in no way really addressed grain reduction, because, of course, it was not going through a DI process. But you have enormous grain reduction tools at your fingertips, something the director didn't initially have. Now, I know the director, and this was all done in sync with the creative team, but was there an issue of whether or not to look at noise reduction?
Yes, but not necessarily in the way you'd think. On this project and one other one we did for the same creative team, we were actually looking at, did we need to add grain?
Oh, really?
Not remember. Yeah. only because one of the things that happens with the ENR photochemical process with the silver retention is it does, in fact, make the film, make the prints grainier than they would otherwise be. And there are, you know, part of the visual language of this movie, certainly part of the edginess, if you will, is the fact that it's a bit on the grainy side. So that becomes part of the, you know, the visual language of the movie. And the question is, now that we're not doing that photochemical process, even though we are getting to the contrast places we need, are we really getting the green we want? And, you know, one of the things, obviously, that 4K helps is, you know, we have no problem seeing the grain with a 4K scan. So adding the contrast brings up enough grain that, you know, in the end, the creatives were perfectly happy with the amount of grain and certainly didn't want to remove any of it.
So we mentioned before that as terrific a grade and look the film initially was, it was a difficult process to, you know, perfect because it was photochemical. Was there a sense in this that you were trying to get a better quality exact match to where you were, or a better quality match to what the director intended and they, you know, got as close as they could the first time round? In other words, were scenes adjusted in the grade?
Well, a lot of things were adjusted a little bit, partly because if the primary intent of this particular restoration is quote video deliverables, unquote, with the word video becoming less defined as we sit here and talk on the phone. if that's the goal, then you have a number of things you have to transport the images across the look. You're going from, you know, 30 feet across and 16 foot Lamberts to 40 inches across and 30 foot Lamberts. And, you know, the whites are a different color and all sorts of things. So there's a lot of translation involved in the first place. But yeah, it opens up the door for the creatives, if they are of such a mind, to rethink some things and go, you know, that came out a little dark. And now that we're doing this from the original negative, let's open it up a tweak. Or, you know, in some cases, they'll go, no, we were perfectly happy with it. We don't want to change it much. Just stay as much to the original intent as you can. So, I mean, and then, of course, there were, you know, in every movie, there's always two or three shots that nobody's happy with. So those always become something to play with. But in this particular case, it was pretty much stay on the track for what the original intent was, although that hasn't always been the case in these kind of projects.
Yeah, it's interesting that there's such a difference between a projected image that's being bounced off and obviously an image that's electronically mastered. But of course, in any normal film, you do a different grade for the theatrical release as to the TV release, or the, call it the TV release, release. But this film, is this setting up a master restoration file that electronically is now, if you like, an electronic digital master that can be put on a archived professional system to be kept, and thus avoiding this ever happening again? And if that's the case, are you needing to sort of have two grades as well? Because, you know, if somebody wants to re-release this theatrically, are they going to go back to your files? Are they going to go back to the neg again for some reason, a 20, 30-year re-release of the film kind of thing?
Well, in this particular case, and this was actually a question we asked the studio portion of the client, how they wanted us to approach it.
Yeah.
And because a film out was not in the original intent, the restored scans have been archived.
Right.
The color corrections have been archived, but the process that we took, which was effectively creating the end of the line first, and then, as usually happens, we got asked, oh, but by the way, now that you've done that, can you make a digital cinema package, which, of course, if you'll pardon the expression, is ass backwards from the way we would approach it ordinarily.
Yeah, absolutely.
We did that, and it's basically a compromise on top of a compromise. And while it looks really pretty good when you sit in the theater and watch it, it would not be the way we would ordinarily do it. But it does exist, and they do have it on the shelf. There is I'm not sure we made them a 4K DCP package, but there is a 2K DCP package with a color trim for the DCI. For the DCI projected space.
Because even a modern film stock is going to deteriorate over time. And theoretically, if you've got a really good professional archiving system that obviously allows for regeneration of the media and multiple copies and stuff, it shouldn't deteriorate. So in a sense, you know, you've captured the film moving forward, and it should... Because at the level you're scanning the film at, I mean, I'm going to stick my neck out here, but then there can't be a heck of a lot more on the neg than you would have got. I know that it wasn't an 8K, but you'd have got pretty close.
Well, the difference between 4K and 8K, I actually hate using those words. I think 6K and 8K describe the mechanisms of scanning, and your result is a 4K file, and then you can talk about how much information got into that file. But, you know, to go 6K, 4K, 11K, whatever you want to do gets into a mine is bigger than yours thing, where, you know, somewhere there's the ghost of a little Swedish guy named Nyquist is laughing at all of us. But I would agree that under the conditions that was photographed in the age of the film stock, that the 4K files we made pretty much captured everything that's on the negative. I'm perfectly safe saying something like that.
And also, I completely agree with you about Nyquist theory, but there is a point at which it is quite nice to overscan, because there is actually a difference between a 6 or 8K scan that's then reduced to 4K for a sensible workflow than a straight 4K scan. I mean, theoretically, you'd think there wouldn't be any difference.
Oh, no. There is a
benefit.
I would totally agree with that on the current restoration. I mean, ever since, for about a year now, we've been running Northlight 2, which is 8K to make 8K scan to make 4K. And you can see the difference in the 4K scans between what Northlight 1 and Northlight 2 did. So, if it's such a point, they give us a machine we can afford that can do scans in a reasonable amount of time that ups the oversampling even more, I'm all for that. But
there is
again, you also
returns.
Have... Yeah, I mean, you know, think of the actual film stock. If they're using older lenses, then the older lenses don't have the MTF of some of the newer ones.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is not Vision 3 negative stock we're talking about.
Yep.
I mean, there's a lot of things that get in there. But, you know, the idea of archiving, I mean, we could have a whole phone conversation about that, because quite frankly, the film will last longer than any digital archive I've yet seen. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why you really want to be careful, or get into a place like we're doing now on another project where we're making scans where the initial intent is to recreate a negative imprint. So we're doing a restoration in a different project where it's like, no, we want to actually make a complete new negative and start all over again.
Now, if I was talking about a restoration of a film from, say, the 60s, and I'm just arbitrarily picking a film, but like imagine it was a much earlier film from a different director, whatever, one of the things we might be talking about here is removing things that are common to a restoration package software. So that would be scratch and dust removal and automatic things to help you with that. In the case of this film, did you have to do anything in the way of scratches, dust, dirt kind of stuff that was, or was the negative, and what condition was that negative in?
The negative was in fairly good shape. I've seen better, and I've certainly seen a lot worse. I'll go that far. There is actually one very brief section here where there was, in fact, a minor scratch on the negative, which when you make an IP through Wetgate, mostly went away through the film process. And our answer to that is we actually had a piece of IP that had been created before the negative was scratched. And we took it, it's about 5 shots, and we took it and we scanned it at 4K like everything else was scanned. And then we did a little bit of sharpening and we matched it in. And in that case, we got pretty lucky, because the scratch tools at the time were having trouble with a particular scratch because it was across somebody's face. Nowadays, on other projects, the scratch tools have kind of improved to the point where you'd have much better luck fixing the scratch from the original negative.
Yeah, I think it also depends on the scratch, doesn't it? I mean, if you've got a scratch that's only one or you know, so emulsion layers, then you can obviously derive a lot of information from the others.
Right.
But if you've got like something that's a deep gouge, then you've got issues.
If you've got a deep gouge, if it wanders around sideways a lot instead of being stable, there's a ton of things that get in there. The tools, obviously the restoration tools get better and better as we sit here, and you know, just the growth between 4 weeks ago and now on some of the projects we're doing, because we're now trying to force, you know, 16-bit files through all of these restoration tools, and they've all had to take a leap in performance and a leap in capabilities just to be able to deal with that safely. So, the tools are evolving literally as we speak.
Can I ask you about the tools? Because you use Baselite, and you can obviously use anything you darn well feel like. What what draws you to find that you can get what you want out of using film lights tools?
Well, the thing that I enjoy using, that I'm using the base light, and I've been running a base light 8 since about 6 or 7 years ago, something like that, one of the very early ones. There are a number of things, one of which is it gives you the horsepower to, when you decide you want to do something crazy, like let's do this at 4K, you can actually play the files and watch them in real time, which is part of you know, color correction when you can't actually punch play and you're skipping around between shots is all good and well, but at the end of the day, you're going to consume this thing in real time from one end to the other. So you really do need to watch it that way. And it's certainly, you know, at this point I take it for granted, but if I was ever put in a situation where I didn't have that, I'd probably, you know, start whining and get very petulant. But, and the other thing about the base light that's actually kind of powerful is it kind of allows you to build the machine you need for the shot you're working on. So, when you get into a situation like, oh, I don't have enough contrast range on this contrast tool to get where I need, it's like, well, I'll just put another layer on and they'll do it twice. Not a problem. And if you get to a place where you don't need it, you don't do it. So, and, you know, other tools, it didn't happen in the title we're talking about, but on the other one that I demonstrated, I had to remove a sound crew. And to do that, I had to repeat a brick wall 4 times and shift it in position. So at 4K. So again, you know, the thing about Base Light 8 is, yes, it presents a fairly large price tag to those who have to pay for stuff like this, but it also presents you with enough power, especially in a digital intermediate context where, yeah, on the restoration we have time. On the digital intermediate, if this was a shot in the end credits and we had to be on the film recorder in 4 hours, we wouldn't have time to put it on a drive, send it to a VFX house, get it back again, put it back in, check to make sure it's right, send it back to them to have it done right the second time. I mean, you don't want to use the tools like that all that often because it's not the most efficient use of the tools, but having that kind of horsepower as a one or two off when you need it is really important, I think.
It seems to me that one of the things that you really want out of a base light is the ability to apply a lot of sort of compute power to make it look like you haven't done anything. And by that I mean...
Well, no, but that's... I mean, you've just hit on one of the crux issues of doing, you know, at grading in the first place is, you know, you don't want whatever you've done to get in the way of the visual storytelling.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to leave no footprints, and people will just, you know, most of them won't even realize, oh my God, you know. And, you know, because I've been in situations with different creative teams where you go through and you'll take your pass and they'll look at it and go, that's too even. You know, it needs to be more disturbing. So you'll go through and, oh, we'll make this one a little darker, we'll make that one a little brighter, we'll do this, that, and the other. So they don't, you know, it's like once you've achieved, you know, what might be considered to be the holy grail of color correction, where you get it to the point where it all looks like it belongs together when it didn't start that way. Now you have a creative going, well, no, that doesn't work for me. I need to disturb that process a little bit.
So when you talk about increasing the contrast by putting it two layers, do you mean by that you run a contrast and then you pipe the output of that through a second contrast, or do you mean that you're layering the image on top of itself?
Well, to get base light specific, the layer that I use to add contrast is called film grade, and it has exposure controls, but it also has a contrast knob, which is certainly something film labs would love to have.
Absolutely.
And right. And in that layer, I literally had the contrast all the way up. And when that happens, if you need more, you just add another layer of the same thing and add a little bit more. And, you know, the way the base light treats it when it actually does the render is it just looks and says, oh, well, I have to, you know, ultimately mathematically I'm creating this final solution. So you don't necessarily get into processing trouble by doing that. Although you can certainly get into trouble revealing warts in your source material by doing it.
Because I think people that maybe have not used the base light are wondering, well, how is that? Why is that you've not got enough contrast? Surely you just keep winding the knob until it, you know, becomes sort of black and white. But in fact, what base light's doing in its contrast is actually sort of cleverer than what I do when I do something simple in Photoshop, in that it's not really completely destroying the whites and destroying the blacks, is it?
Well, no, there is. You can do it that way if you want, but there is, in fact, a way to to change the curve at what would be called the toe, you know, the knee and the toe, or the highlights and lowlights, to give you what amounts to very film-looking curves. You can basically I built a transfer curve that looks a lot like what an ENR photochemical process does. It was just, I couldn't quite get there in one shot, so I had to kick it a little bit.
I think that's what's really key about when you go to something like Baselite with somebody that is experienced like you, that you're getting a contrasty thing that still looks filmic. It still has the roll-off into the highlights. It still has the filmic qualities that are inherent in film. You haven't wound the contrast up and made it look like a HD-sourced piece of footage, which, of course, has reduced dynamic range by its capture medium. So it's, in fact, it seems to me that what Baselite's really good at being able to let you do is you can get what you want out, but you don't sort of stop it looking like film in the process. Would you agree?
No. And one of the things that helps with that is the fact that, regardless of what you're building on the timeline and what kind of processor you're doing, it's all virtual. Ultimately, until you build a render command and say, make it look that way, the source material hasn't changed any. So whatever is in the source material is still there. And if you discover that you've stepped on it somehow, it's pretty easy to go back and go, oh, well, I painted myself in a corner, but here's a little step ladder, and I'll just walk out of this and fix it.
I've visited Laser Pacific a few times over the years, and going back many years, I've just always been struck by the fact that Laser Pacific seems to be a facility that, more than almost any other facility I've ever got, it really seems to have its act together in terms of how it treats material, because there was always a sense of it was never good enough is good enough. It was always like, there was a meticulous kind of attention to detail. I presume that this is what helps you either side of your process. In other words, your scanning department, your entire team contribute to, because I think one of the things that we can slightly lose sight of is that as terrific as any one process is, it's obviously only as strong as the weakest link. And I've always been really impressed with Laser Pacific for having an arc of meticulously caring about every step. That must have backed you up on this.
Our scanning department is actually first rate, and I have an assist who came with me from elsewhere who's also very good at watching over this. So, obviously for any project like this that you're coming off film, you don't get the scans right, you don't get anything else right. I mean, it's pretty simple in that respect. At this point, especially in a world of DI, what I will say is that, as a colorist, the work is now more complex than you're not working by yourself anymore like you were 15 or 20 years ago. So, our restoration department is first rate, and our QC department, which is, who goes and looks at it after the restoration department, and went, wait, you missed something over here. And, because it's a whole cycle and the whole process. There's a whole big team of people that make it work. And, we're lucky enough here to be surrounded by the first rate people on projects like this.
Yes. I remember visiting Laser Pacific when they were doing some of the best standards conversions in the world. And Randy, who was then the chief engineer, said to me, I asked him how he managed to get stuff looking so good at the other end. He said, well, really, the whole principle of Laser Pacific is if you put crap in, you get crap out. So you have to pay attention right from the get-go. And I can't imagine that being even more close than in film restoration.
Well, more and more, as things get more and more complicated and as a comment on DIs, especially now that we're dealing with electronic cameras, none of that is actually getting simpler.
No, it's
even
not.
Even though people would like to think it's getting simpler, if you look at what it would take to shoot any of that stuff on film, there'd be a DP with a light meter going, give me a T4, please, thank you. And then you look at what has to happen, with any of the electronic cameras, and it's like, what are all these people? But
Lou, I just don't want to be rude about any current DP working today, but isn't there a sense you get that the DPs of the era of Saving Private Ryan, when you had no safety net, I just admire their ability to nail consistency in film, because it feels today with digital that there's an assumption that we can even everything out later, but there's something jaw-dropping about how good the DPs got it when they didn't have a DI to back them up, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think if you, you know, I mean, where you really have to show your respect is go back a generation before what we're talking about, or, you know, back to the era when they were shooting these things, you know, with ASA 50 film stock, right? And it's like, oh my God, you know, it's like, and the film stock had no dynamic range, so if you missed by like 4 or 5 points, you were in trouble, right? And nowadays, with 5219, you miss by 4 points, you won't even notice it.
Yeah. So, in fact, you might not even know
well,
it.
Those are the guys to... Yeah, I'm sorry, because, you know, I'm lucky enough to be an associate member of the ASC, and when you walk into the clubhouse and you see the picture of those guys on the sets, those are the guys that have, like, a 3-inch wide path to walk or they fell off. But, you know, those are the guys you really need to have respect for to get it to work at all under those conditions. Was just really amazing by what we have to go through today.
Yeah. Well, look, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thanks to Mike and to Lou for that interview. I think that I'd be one of the first people to line up for a T-shirt with the slogan, "Somewhere there's a ghost of Nyquist laughing at us." Anyway, that'll do it for this FX podcast. For my partners Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.